Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hey, Mona. Hey, Rebecca.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
You know, there is still a lot of buzz and a lot of excitement with regard to this new EB5 legislation.
Yeah, it's going to continue for some time because as everybody is digesting everything that is in the legislation and how it will affect themselves and basically how little guidance there is out there, there are more and more queries and questions. And as you've seen, Mark, there's a ton of webinars about this with everybody having a different opinion.
Yeah, I was attending a recent ILW webinar. Mona, you were speaker up there.
I was.
Usually there's like a handful of people, maybe a couple dozen, but it seemed like the room was maxed out.
Oh my.
Did everybody get in?
No, that was amazing. I don't think I've ever been on a webinar which is so well attended. And it was more or less similar questions to a previous webinar, but I guess people just want as much as possible as far as information. There were people kicked off that. They maxed out the number of seats.
As a speaker, I'm sure you see a lot of the questions come into the back end that don't necessarily make it up to the webinar. Did they all kind of revolve around a certain topic?
Well, that's the reason why we're having this podcast. Yeah. I would say on that particular webinar, 65% of the questions, maybe 70, were related to concurrent filing. And saying that, Rebecca and I are inundated with questions, emails, texts, WhatsApp messages, calls from our investor clients and others asking the same questions.
Yeah, so we went from one deadline, Mark, to another intense filing.
I know. You know, I even dared to suggest that I could have a couple of days off skiing. and they look, you take a day off or no?
Well, I'm sure you get a lot of questions. Let me be the first one to ask, what is concurrent filing?
Rebecca, take it away.
Okay, thanks.
Well, there is a lot of information out there, Mark, on concurrent filing, right? But I feel like a lot of people don't understand the petitions themselves, or there's so many numbers to these forms, it can get really confusing. So we thought we'll kind of make it simpler to understand. We're going to start, especially with it focusing on EB5. Concurrent filing can work for other cases as well.
EB5 is a little different, or has been different, Rebecca, right?
Yes. It has been different because we're going to start with your underlying petition, your basic EB5 petition, which most people know is your I-526. You're filing this for your source of funds and your project information. Once you get approved, only then can you file for your adjustment of status within the United States. What the law has done is now you can concurrently file or file at the same time your I-526 or your basic underlying EB-5 petition with the adjustment of status.
Oh, wow. But Rebecca, this is like amazing news. And I remember mentioning this to Sam on our last podcast, that this was such a big deal. And from the excitement we're seeing, it is a big deal. But there are ifs and buts to this, right?
Yeah, well, you know, it's exciting because a lot of clients or investors now can have that benefit of having your work permit and your travel document, which we're going to get into more later. But that's the benefit of being able to concurrently file. Whereas before, you could not, you had to wait until that EB-5 petition was approved.
Right. And you know, Mark, we've done a lot of podcasts on mandamus petitions. Mm-hmm. And many a time, investors have been forced into filing mandamus petitions because they're losing their status here in the US, or they're losing their job just because the petition has taken so long to adjudicate. So with the ability to be able to concurrently file, at least they have a work permit and can carry on with their job. I do think the litigation will lessen a little. I say a little because such a litigious
I feel like the applications are still taking a long time. Let's see what happens with USCIS on that.
Oh, if you could see me now, I would be rolling my eyes. Do you think with all the numbers, Rebecca, we're going to see additional adjudicators?
Let's hope. I mean, they have increased, right? They have increased fees. So hopefully we'll see more adjudication, faster adjudication. I mean, just today, which I know this is timestamped, but it's March 29th, USCIS did announce that they are trying to find a way to have increased efficiency in the overall legal immigration system. So.
Okay, I say no more. Rebecca, let's get back to topic.
That's what all the premium processing fees are for, right?
There's no premium processing in EB-5, Mark, and I don't think we'll ever see it because of the nature of the type of work, you know, because of the project. Although saying that, maybe in the future, once they've got into the whole gear of the project being approved, once the project's approved, maybe that they will have a sort of premium processing. But that's all in the future.
And that could be another topic for another day.
Yeah.
But focusing on the here and now, we're talking about concurrent filing. And it sounds like the big benefit for foreign nationals that are going to be investors in the U.S. is they can file for their EB-5 and also their removal of conditions.
Not removal.
No.
Okay.
So that's the third step. There's three steps in EB-5. So what we can do is you can file for your first and second step if you're within the United States.
Yeah, that's the big proviso. So when we say within the United States, Rebecca, who are we talking about?
So we're speaking of those who are in the United States on a valid non-immigrant visa, meaning H-1Bs, E-2s, student visas, you know, any other valid non-immigrant visas. Yeah.
O's, P's.
O's, P's.
Extraordinary.
With the list goes on.
Yeah. Okay. But what about the people who are visiting here on a B1, B2? That's a non-immigrant visa. Wouldn't that allow them to be?
Well, that's where it gets tricky. So with a B1, B2, we have the issue with intent, meaning that when you're coming into the U.S. on a B1, B2, your intent is to visit, or it's a temporary visit to the U.S. So your intent is not to stay and adjust your status to that of an immigrant petition, or meaning getting your green card. So although it's for a temporary visit, Mona, we think that those who are in the U.S. now, who were physically present at the time this came into law, could actually file for adjustment of status.
That's right. I think there's a lot of opinion on this, and almost all lawyers do come out with the same conclusion, that if you were in the United States at the time the bill was filed or signed, you don't have that same intent, because you did intend to leave when you entered, but then the bill came in, and honestly, this provision was not given the same attention that other provisions were. And for a lot of people, it was a surprise, as we know. So I believe that if you are in the United States, or you've extended your visa for some other reason, and you're on a B1, B2, and you want to adjust while you're here, you'll be fine. I don't think you're going to be fine if you're now overseas and you suddenly hear of this and you want to come in. But Rebecca, what happens if you are overseas, you come in and you're here for 3 months, like 90 days? That seems to be the magic number.
Yes.
On day 91, can they adjust?
So I'm always hesitant to say that, because even though you're here for 90 days and you could kind of overcome that intent, I feel that if you're still filing thereafter, USCIS can still question you on whether or not was it really your intent when you first came in. Mm-hmm. So I know some attorneys will say, go ahead and file it. I feel like it's a case-by-case basis. I, like I said, just a bit hesitant when it comes to that.
Okay, so can anybody and everybody file concurrently?
I wish I can say yes, but at this time, it's not, your country, as unfortunately China is backlogged again, so your country cannot be in backlog for you to concurrently file. You have to have a visa available at the time of filing.
Okay, so here was something which I said on one of the webinars, I do remember, that at this point, all countries are current. And then I was told, no, China isn't. But China is current for direct visas, for direct projects, right?
Yes, they can file under the direct program. They cannot file under the regional center program. And this is all under Chart B of the visa bulletin. So we don't want to get into too much details on that. But if you are in the U.S., you have a pending I-526, you can file under the direct program, for all countries. And under the Regional Center program, all countries except China.
Okay, what if I'm from South Korea and I file a petition, I file concurrently, and next year South Korea suddenly goes into backlog and I need to renew my EAD or I want someone else to come in? What happens then?
So you can renew your EAD. Okay. Unfortunately, though, if your I-526 or your EB-5 underlying petition is not approved, is approved, at that point, what USCIS will do is hold on to your application, your I-45 or your adjustment of status application until a visa becomes available.
Mm. So now one of the big questions, which, as I said, there were so many questions on this webinar, mm-hmm. which came in. One of the questions was, I'm on an H-1B. If I apply for my EAD, will I lose my H-1B?
No. So there's a lot of misconceptions of that. And I mean, I can't tell you how many clients we've spoken to already within the last week asking that same question. No, you're fine to file because H-1B, you do have that dual intent. So you can have an adjustment of status pending while you still continue on your H-1B. And I like to advise clients to keep your H-1 unless you absolutely hate your job or there's some issue with your H-1B. I would say use that, travel in and out, work on that. But you can use the advanced parole employment authorization document in case something happens in the future.
Well, with a lot of our H-1B clients, they do have what's called the sixth year filing, and they're able to go over 6 years because the duration, maximum duration on an H-1B is 6 years. But for clients who are, for example, are here on an L-1, on intercompany transfer, they don't have that luxury. It's a specific time, which doesn't extend. So for a client from a country where, or a visa which was an L-1, what would you suggest?
So I would suggest staying on the L-1 as long as possible, and then you can go ahead and switch to the EAD and advanced parole. At least it continues your status in the U.S., and you don't have to worry about losing or going back to your home country and waiting for the EB-5 petition to get approved.
So when you file concurrently, one of the advantages, Rebecca, is supposedly the speed of getting your green card. Have you seen that happen?
At the end of the day, you still have to get your EB-5, the underlying petition, approved. But what it does help with is that you already have the adjustment of status filed. So once that's approved, USCIS can automatically go ahead and start adjudicating your I-45 or adjustment of status application. So it's not to say that it's going to expedite your case in any way, but it does help to kind of shorten the time period. I think the benefit and what most people look for when concurrently filing is making sure they have that EAD and advanced parole. I think it helps more of our like students, those who are in those positions where, like you said, they don't have that duration where they can keep extending. That's where this concurrent filing really helps.
Well, what about some of the conditions required to get your the concurrent filing, such as a medical certificate? Because medical certificates, they last, what, 1 or 2 years only?
So they used to last 1 year. Okay. And then because of COVID, I think that was like the bane of our existence. So because of that, they have extended it for 2 years. So I think, Mona, you and I were discussing this with the office. We're still encouraging our clients to go ahead and get the medical. Because one, you can file without it, but I'm always scared, what if it is rejected?
Right.
There's some USCIS officers who, you know, may not see that and just reject it because they don't think you have a medical. And two, it delays your petition ultimately at the end of the day because you're going to get an RFE to go ahead and file your medical, and then you're kind of wasting time on that end.
I totally agree. All right. For our listeners who are listening and they keep hearing you talk about an advanced parole, what is an advanced parole document?
The advanced parole document is your travel document. So it's your permission to travel and enter in the United States.
If I have an H-1 or I have another visa, then I don't need that permission, do I?
No, you don't. You can go ahead and travel on your H-1B, and especially to maintain your H-1B. As soon as you use that EAD or advanced parole, so usually they're a combo card. So as soon as you use that, you automatically then switch to that status and you will end up losing the H-1B. So I always tell my clients, take it, put it in your back pocket, don't show it unless you absolutely need it.
Once I have filed for my concurrent filing, though, why do I need permission to leave? Will my petition be deemed abandoned if I don't have permission?
That's a very good question, Mona, and that's really case by case, right? It depends on your visa. If you have a pending I-45 and you need to travel, you're fine to travel because you'll travel on your H-1B. Your I-45 will still remain pending, right? The issue would be whether or not your advanced parole may get denied because they would say you're abandoning your advanced parole. But for an H-1B holder, if you're continuing on your H-1, that makes no difference to you, right? The B-1, B-2 applicant is going to have an issue. If you're here on the B-1, B-2 and you decide to leave, then your entire application is deemed abandoned if you travel without the advanced parole. So that you have to be very careful.
You know, I feel like this provision of concurrent filing has totally switched the marketing aspect of EB-5. Whereas, people do, and they still will, of course, go overseas to get overseas applicants, overseas investors. This concurrent filing really suits locals, whether you're on an H-1 or you're a student. You know, it really changes the dynamics.
Yeah, it does. But I also think, we've seen a lot of H-1B who filed it previously as well. So they're lucky enough to have got under the 500,000 and now get the benefit of concurrent filing as well. Because
oh, yeah, that was another question. Yeah. Is it future people only or does it go backwards? And I think you've answered that.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people question them. So it's beneficial for all of those. The only ones who kind of have to still wait are those who investors who are going to file under the regional center program. And that's because of that whole 60 days regional centers have to wait to file a petition. So you obviously those petitions you can't concurrently file at the moment, but direct moving forward can file concurrent.
So this was in the legislation that nothing can be filed for 60 days from the date of enactment, which I believe ended up being, I think, March 15.
Yes.
And so we're talking about May 15 being 60 days.
Yes. Yes.
But so, can we not file the current petitions or are any petitions being rejected?
So we have not filed as yet because we were kind of hesitant as well. And I know a lot of our clients rushed us and said, let's get that out there. But we have heard of these being rejected. And I think that's because USCIS hasn't yet been able to update and figure out what they're doing. But I think moving forward now, because their website says that they understand that the laws have changed, I don't think they will be rejecting in the coming days.
Yeah. Mark, we're talking about many, many petitions because we are still waiting for adjudications going back to 2018. Because 2019, there was this huge rush prior to the onslaught of the regulations in November 21st, mm-hmm. 2019. And then, of course, after that, during COVID and during this period, USCIS is just missing in action. Slowdown's an understatement. You know, mm-hmm. We often joke is that all they do is drink coffee, but obviously they were doing other stuff too. But the bottom line is that there are many people out there who will benefit from this provision.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think this was something that was talked about for a long time, Mona. I remember for a very long time that we kept asking for a concurrent filing.
It's been in the draft legislation since 2015.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody really had any objections. It was the expedited petition that people had objections for, the premium processing rather.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Because premium processing forces USCIS to adjudicate within a 3-week period. And they don't like to be forced to do that in most cases.
Yeah. And to be fair, these petitions are a lot heavier than others. So I wouldn't want them to rush a petition either or just start giving RFEs for no reason.
Yeah, I agree. And believe it or not, Mark, we are still in the old way, in the olden days in EB-5. Everything is paper. It's paper intensive. And that's been quoted as one of the reasons why there was such delays during COVID, because everything else you can file online. But for EB-5, you know, the stacks of papers, we filed petitions with 91 pounds of supporting documents. Yeah. The boxes have got bigger and bigger. In fact, we take photos photographs of the boxes when we're sending them out, and our clients just cannot believe that's how big the petition is. So it is difficult looking at all of those documents on the computer, especially if you're working from home on a little laptop. So I do understand why they want the paper.
Yeah, yeah. And that, yeah, can't imagine lugging 91 pounds of documents home with me. So it was understandable. It's just that I hope, as they said, that they're going to ramp up, you know, trying to figure out premium processing and reducing backlogs. So I really do hope they try to improve moving forward.
Well, they should. It has the highest filing fee amongst all, and it has the slowest turnover. So
yeah. And not to say that they're going to start charging an additional fee as well moving forward for these petitions. So they have to do something.
There's going to be lots of additional fees. In fact, Mark, we've got lots of exciting things coming up because we're going to spend episodes talking about all the other provisions like fund management, for example, which is now becoming mandatory. And that's just going to be an add-on for investors because it's got to come out of administrative fees.
Yeah, so there's a lot to discuss. There's a lot of dissecting. Again, we're still digesting ourselves. We're going to see policy memos coming out from USCIS. So there's a lot
and
more
policy
to
memos and policy memos being challenged, no doubt.
Yes,
from
<I'm sure.
laughs> our litigious friends.
So I think we have an interesting road ahead of us. I think it's exciting. We're just happy that USCIS came, or I should say Congress, has brought back the regional center program.
Rebecca, one of the questions which was asked was relating to where we should file. I don't think anything has changed in this law, right? It's just the normal procedure?
Yes, it would be the normal procedure. And I-526 petitions are filed with the California Service Center anyway. So if you're going to do concurrent filing, it would be to there as well.
Well, hey, let me jump in here real quick. Rebecca, earlier you were mentioning Chart B versus Chart A. What is that regarding to?
It's on the visa bulletin, meaning that the Department of State has certain dates that if a certain category under a certain country, if they're oversubscribed, they will put a date on these charts to say that for those who have filed prior to that date can go ahead and either file their adjustment of status if you're in the U.S., or you could do consular processing if you're outside of the U.S. So it's important for today's conversation. So I'm just going to bring it back to adjustment of status because you would be able to file your adjustment of status application or concurrently file because under Chart B, which is the dates for filing, meaning you could file your adjustment of status applications, is current for all countries under the direct program and for all countries under the regional center program except for China. Yeah, and so that date.
Mm-hmm. You know, Mark, it's really good that many of the events have started up again, and you'll hear from us on that. But in every event which IIUSA do, they always have a seminar by Charlie Oppenheim, who's the head of the chief of the Department of State.
He's retired now.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yes.
I wonder if he's still coming. But that event is so well attended. Everybody crowds into that room and they wait with bated breath as Charlie opens. He puts the slide and everybody goes when they see the visa numbers and see who's going to go into backlog and who isn't.
So it's interesting because, again, the Chart A and Chart B is kind of new. It's only been out for a few years. I remember when it was so chaotic to understand what was going on. But the final action date, which is Chart A, means that you can actually adjudicate the I-45 application once your EB-5 underlying petition is approved. But you can go ahead and file. So at least it's sitting there. You don't have to worry about doing this later or, you know, but unfortunately for those who are born in China, the date is December 15th of 2015. So you can only file for adjustment of status or consular processing if you've filed before that date under the Regional Center Program.
Well, Mother Rebecca, thank you so much for explaining concurrent filing and how it relates to EB-5. I know we're going to be talking about other aspects of the new legislation as it pertains to EB-5 because there's so many additional questions out there, right?
Right. And even you'd be surprised how many people really don't understand what concurrent filing really means.
Well, that was me 30 minutes ago.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshawlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.